This is Fantamalytic Ghost, and we're live on the air with Kim Corti for the first time. Welcome to the Fantamalytic Ghost podcast. How are you doing tonight?
I am fantastic. How are you?
I'm doing all right. Want to let people know a couple of things. You can listen to us on Newsly. We are a featured podcast on that platform. You can see that little icon up there. Those of you who haven't tried that, you can use a free coupon code of Ghost. We will be on the Newsly platform as a featured podcast later tonight. In the audio version of the podcast, we also have your URL of kimcorti.com, and that will be fully clickable for anybody who wants to click on that. Don't have to worry about remembering it. You'll be able to click through on that. And so, again, welcome to the Fantamalytic Ghost podcast.
Oh, thanks. I'm really excited. This is my first live interview, so it's exciting.
One of the questions we like to ask every guest that comes on the show with the two of questions, in fact, what motivates you and why do you do what you do?
What motivates me? I guess wanting to make other people's lives better. I think we all go through, we all have to go through our own experiences. But if I can do anything to help people go down a path that is a little bit more conscious or insightful or helps them to have less bumps in their road, that makes me happy. So I would say just trying to be helpful to others, be of service to people.
That's a good place
to kind question? Of start.
I think the second question was well, why do you do what you do? Another one was what motivates you. So it's kind of like why you got the passion to do what you do, maybe.
Yeah, I think that my passion was just because of my own issues. We can get into it now, but I basically had a very difficult time in my life, and I was going through a very painful divorce, literally laying on the floor of my condo for I don't know how long. It was light and then it was dark when I woke up, just thinking like, how did I get here? How can I keep this from happening to me again? And it wasn't the only event in life, but I realized cumulatively my responses, my just all kinds of things that I was not being conscious of, and tried to take a more active, proactive course in my life.
That's interesting, because I was looking at like what you actually do is a sensory perception emotion management strategist.
Yes.
And maybe you can talk about what that actually is. And then combination is you have your latest book, which is, I hope I get the title right, Yucky, Yummy, Savory, Sweet. That's the title?
Yes, it's Yucky, Yummy, Savory, Sweet, Understanding the Flavors of Emotions. And so sensory perception and managing that and your emotions go hand in hand. And a lot of us don't really think about it that way. And I quite frankly didn't either until I read this book, How Emotions Are Made, The Secret Life of the Brain. Everybody's heard about wiring, right? Of like, you know, rewire your brain, all that. But what do we do about what's been wired? And I know they say rewired, but what does it mean? What does this wiring mean? How did it get wired? And more importantly for me is how did our perceptions play a part in that? Because we respond to the outside world, right? We see things, we hear things, we smell things, we touch things. And these are best guesses of our brain. So me looking at you is actually a prediction of the brain. It is what I smell is a prediction of the brain. Everything we experience is a prediction of the brain. And this is the thing, the brain can get things wrong. Or it can be very focused and filter out about a bunch of stuff, or it can be more broad. And there's all kinds of things that we miss, but it's these perceptions that are the ingredients for our emotions. And so if you think about it that way, your perceptions, what's going on outside and inside of your world, there's a word that's called interoception. And it is our sensory system that tells us how we feel inside of our bodies. So this is what the brain does on the inside with the inside information. So anyway, excuse me, I've had this frog. I really apologize. But the brain uses these prior wiring, so I call them recipes. So all of this experience and a memory, an experience, learning, all of these things are all the same. It's that combination of things that have taken place and how we feel about it. And that's what gets put into our quote unquote recipe. And then as these ingredients appear in our brain, right? Like we've got all this sensory information, 11 billion bits a second, and we're conscious of like 124. So it's trying to make sense of that information, and it's using these recipes to launch our feelings. And most of the time, it's our feelings that will drive our thoughts, decisions, and behaviors, because in our experiences, mostly it's how we felt and what was going on at the time. So that's a kind of how ingredients are used, or how sensory perception is used. And then how we taste these recipes that get cooked is that interoception that I talked about. And I like to say it's how, you know, if you type it in, you'll get spell checked and it'll say interception. So Think of it as how you catch your feelings, how you feel inside of your body. And that's when we're able to connect to those feelings, that's how well we can taste the recipes, that the emotion recipes that the body produces.
I understand somewhat. I was a liberal arts major, but part of what I took was some philosophy, and you know, Camus and Sartre, and the idea of like perception versus reality, and kind of like, oh, if something falls in the forest and you're not there, did it really happen, right? And then the perception of like what you see and what you hear is not necessarily like everybody, you know, being a musician, if I write a song and I have my own idea what it is, the fans interpret it however their brain interprets it. And a lot of times lyrics are misinterpreted. Mm-hmm. Visions are called up because that is relevant to you. So when you hear the melody, you get a picture in your head that's not like the picture that everybody else has. It's very personal. It's very unique. It's a moment that gets recalled. It's not always the same. It might be melancholy, might be happy, might be sad, might be what, but it's uniquely like yours. And so the perception versus reality is sometimes it's not exactly what you think it is.
And yet so many of us have no room for belief that we could have what is scientists call as a prediction error. And what you're saying is spot on, because when you think of like a car accident, you can have five different accounts of that car accident and five different people, all of their stories could be true, but it's just a piece of the story. And we have to factor in that we can see things too that aren't there, that the brain might get wrong. You're out and about and you see somebody and you think you know them. So you go up to say hello and they turn around and you're like, oh wait, it's not you. It's like your brain gets the picture and it made an error. Well, it can do the same thing with our emotions. And the going back to what you were saying is when you think about like how weird this whole concept is, like that what you were talking about, you know, consciousness philosophers, they talk about what is red. Like you have phantom, in Phantom Electric, you've got this really vibrant red. But when you look at it and I look at it, I have no clue if you see the same red as I do. Mm-hmm. And there's no way to prove it, right? Because it's impossible. Our world is constructed in our heads. And we start doing that from the time we're a child. We learn what a ball is. We learn the difference between different balls. You know, there's a balloon, and then there's a rubber bouncing ball. There's a baseball, a basketball. I mean, it's endless. We learn these distinctions. But what we don't learn, and I'm trying to bring forth into the world, is better able to distinguish our emotions, to make a distinction between our different emotional states, and also between our feelings, because they don't come in the same. There's two different flavors of feelings. There's homeostatic, which is like the feeling of being hungry, the feeling of being tired, the feeling you need to use the restroom. These are all signals that the body's giving you to take, care of yourself, because it's helping you to stay alive, right? Sleep, necessary. Food, necessary. You know, if your heart is beating too fast, hey, you need to do something to slow it down because it's not good for you. Otherwise, you don't notice it. So the same is true of our feeling states. Like, so we use the same body parts to feel it. You feel a racing heart in the same place you feel love. And so sometimes we can't distinguish the emotions, and it's our increased interoceptive awareness, that increased connection to how we feel inside, that helps us to get that distinction, just like we can tell the difference between a balloon and a basketball.
Well, I think it's like anything. Like if you're a musician or an athlete, you have to practice. Like you don't get that 3-point shot unless you practice. Like if I don't get my baseline unless I know where the notes are on my bass, right? I have to practice. I think with people being emotionally connected is they don't practice, right? Like if you never do some kind of exercise, emotional exercise, like after talking or reading a book by somebody like yourself, to actually recognize things like patterns or recognize connections. If you kind of walk and say, well, I don't need to do that because that's foo-foo and I don't need to think about it, or it just happens. And like, I think people need to understand, well, how does it work? Like, if you don't know how it works, well, how are you ever going to get it?
Yes. I will tell you too, as in my case, I got really good at not feeling. So it's a shame that it's called this, but you know, there's cognitive dissonance, willful blindness. Yeah, there's terms for it where you're not connected to those feelings. And so what this book is about is helping you to do that, because you know, the sensations of flavor are very similar to the sensations that we have with emotions, in that it's multi-sensory. To taste food, and I'm going to restate that, to get the flavors in the food you taste, because flavor and taste are different. Flavor can involve your sense of smell. Everybody knew about that from COVID, right? Like you couldn't taste your food because
sense of smell. It's a couple things.
but they also know that your vision, like what you see
vision
on the plate,
tied to it,
if it doesn't look good, if it looks like mush, it could taste like the best thing on earth, but someone might not eat it just because of how it looks, or
psych themselves music.
Music playing in the background. The last time you ate any dish that looked similar to it, that you had a bad experience. So the whole idea of flavor is multi-sensory, and so are our emotions. It's getting more comfortable with tasting them. And it might mean just getting used to connecting to taste or connecting to sensations in your body. Just noticing your toes, being able to look at after an experience and say, well, how did that feel in my body? And to be able to notice it and to practice noticing it. Because like when a chef takes a sip of their food, the more that they sip it and they sit with it and notice it, it becomes easier and easier and easier. So the idea of my book is just trying to understand how that works, and then steps. And there's actually exercises for you to grow as an emotion chef so that you can become even more connected and actually learn how to engage in critical thinking. I mean, if our brain is wrong, you know, that often, and we can do things to try and make it better at prediction. And that's really what I'm trying to help people do.
It's not about mapping. I'm a computer, you know, science person. Everything gets mapped, which means kind of like what does this actually equal, right? Like we do a lot of mapping exercises that connect things. And then sometimes things are not connected, right? So somehow the input that you put in is mapped to the wrong, like filter or the wrong thing. So it doesn't find the right information. So that's kind of like what happens in your brain. The computer is the same way. Like if it understands, you have to explicitly tell it what to do. Like your brain kind of needs to know. Like if you've got these preconceived notions, like that X is this, but X is really not that. It's something else. But you've been kind of shown that you believe that's the truth and it's a belief. And so now You've got it mapped wrong. Just like the computer could have the dollar amount mapped to the percentage and it's the wrong thing. So it's going to get the wrong information. It's not that, I mean, it's kind of simplified, but I think the same thing happens.
Yeah. the crazy thing that happens with us is that we have so many factors that we don't know about. Like, and I'm not disagreeing with you by any means, because, you know, there is a bit of it. It's simplified, true, but we do have the ability to try and have some control into what we choose and to our feelings, and to understand we have that control, like you're talking about, is so important, because nobody else is gonna change how you feel but you. You know, we're like, I want you to do this, like you make me feel this way, and it's really us that's responsible, and that's part of the harder part. But the other thing that I also like to throw out there, that when you think about the complexities of the human, we have what I call a secret sauce. So we have our inherited genomes, like our gene pool that might predispose us to certain personality traits, or like my sister is so much like my mom emotionally. And it's crazy, even as older as she's gotten, you know, we see it more, but it's not like it means that's, she's stuck. It just means that's how she was.
It's kind of a default.
Built. Like, yeah, it's default. How she was.
Exactly. Any default position can be kind of updated, right? And even though I had a very simple example, there's a lot of things that are multivariate, right? There's multi-inputs. Like, so you could have hundreds of inputs. And you could, you know, but maybe you can't get a hold of that, right? So you try to bring it down to like something you can manage. Top 10, top 5 things. Because behind the scenes, subconsciously, there could be all these other things. Like you said, you're getting your smell, your sight, your kind of you know, like your vibe, which is hard to kind of feel. Like you walk in a room, you get a vibe from somebody. Well, how do you define that? Well, it happens, but how do you know what that input is? Because you get the vibe. And so it's not what your eyes saw. It's not what your ears saw. It's just like, it's kind of like energy. Like energy level that we kind of are tapped into. And that's a whole kind of esoteric thing, but there's a lot of factors. And it's like, what can you pin it down to something that you can manage? Because you get an overload. You probably can't do 1,000. Maybe you could do 5 or 10, even 10 might be too much to kind of get a hold of in your mind.
I'm sorry. Maybe I got a little bit lost. 5 or 10. What?
Like like inputs. Like if you're saying there's multiple inputs to how you feel, right? There's multiple situations. Part of it could be the scent, the sound.
Yes.
A word trigger, a moment, a song. So, you know, there's so many things that could happen in one moment. It's not just one thing. It's a bunch of things. But how many of those things could you actually understand as a trigger? And actually be aware of it. If there's too much, you couldn't get a hold of the whole thing. You know, you can't kind of process it.
I hear you. But just as an aside, you know, you were talking about feeling somebody's energy, and we actually, you know, have our heart generates, you know, is the highest generator of electromagnetic energy. And it's also always been called the seat of emotion. It's where we have a tiny, small brain. Obviously not like a brain in the head, but it does function. It has 40,000 neurons, and it has wiring and all that other kind of stuff. So we do actually produce electromagnetic energy at our very atom. We are a bunch of fields, you know, vibrating fields. So we are just a bunch of vibrating beings. So I thought I would just throw that out there. But there was another point when you were talking about that. I was just trying to say, though, is that, you know, it's not about what we can't control, the secret sauce, the things that we have maybe hormone imbalance, you know, if we're ill, if we're not getting enough sleep. I mean, you know, these are things that we can try and address either, you know, with the help of a doctor or, you know, getting your sleep, eating right, like everything, it all plays into each other. In fact, there is an instantaneous change to your immune system with your emotions. So your emotions make you sick in multiple ways. One of them can be with overproduction of cortisol, but the other can just be it wears down yourself physically. And so anyway, my point is that these are the things that you can control. And so, I mean, why not try to, right? Like, why not, in this mental health world, you know, trying to eat the best that we can is really difficult, but it's because food is so expensive, because there's so many additives, there's so many chemicals in our food. It's been commented on that people who eat, you know, 24/7 are starving nutritionally. So, you know, doing things to amp up your nutrition, either through supplementation or better foods. I mean, all of this plays into how we respond emotionally, and more importantly, how your brain and your physical body is responding.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, because, you know, the idea of like recipes, and I know there was a mention of Food Network and chefs, and there's a specific mention to a Food Network show called Chopped.
Yes.
In relation to your brain works. And then maybe you can talk about kind of expanding on what that actually means, or what you meant there.
I'd be happy to. The show is called, it's on the Food Network, and it's called Chopped. And the whole idea is there's four guest chef contestants. Very few times are they home chefs, but sometimes they are. It's restaurant chefs. And so they're trained. And they all share the same kitchen with multiple ingredients, but that they can access for their different contests. So there's a appetizer, a main dish, and a dessert. They that's what they base their win on. And they get the same ingredients in a basket, and they have to use those ingredients. They have to be in whatever food they produce, and they all use it differently. So the point of it is that they are using their culture, they're using past experience, they're using things that influence them to have the exact same ingredients and yet have different outcomes, different outputs. And if you have a malfunction, as one contestant did, the equipment malfunctioned and he lost because of it. And so that's why it's so important for us to make sure that our body, our kitchen, our brain, and everything that we are is in great, it's as high of condition as we can possibly do it, just because it's so tied into how we can produce our final dish.
Also, it seems like there's a lot of pillars to your overall health. Like you mentioned, like your mental state and then your emotional state, your kind of spiritual state and your physical state, right? So I've met some people on the podcast that have been like, you know, fitness coaches that had six pack abs that were totally outwardly looking great, but mentally they admitted they had a lot of dysfunction. They didn't feel good. And so they felt kind of like shame because they're presenting this thing and they were kind of feeling like they were feeling imposter syndrome. But outwardly, people might not see that. They're like, well, this guy looks perfect. And, you know, it looks like totally fine. So there's a lot of things, like sometimes it's like you can outwardly look one way, but inwardly, maybe you are not what you appear to be, or you're not fully like functioning. Like you said, something broke down, and that something that broke down might not be easily, readily apparent.
No. And that's why having that ability to self-assess and to see what's going on in your body is really important. it triggered, I use this example a lot in podcasts because I thought it was a great example of someone. It was a father. He was videotaping his daughter crying. It was on like for social media. And he's like, "Why are you crying?" And she's like, "I don't know." And she was just bawling. And she just sat with herself for a minute. And she said, he's like, "But you're sad. Why are you sad?" And she's like, "I don't know." So then she decides she's going to get something to eat and watch her favorite show. And he's like, "Do you feel better now?" And she's like, "Yes." So my point of this story is that her dad was telling her she was sad and she was really hungry and just needed to sit and get some food in her. And, yeah. And so, you know, when we do things like that, where we think, "Oh, the food made me feel better because it cured my sadness, not because it cured my hunger." And so I think that's when we can start to get our wires crossed. And why, when you are looking at someone who is outwardly, physically just like looks amazing, but maybe they're starving themselves. And so maybe this person is feeling bad about themselves because they just don't have the blood sugar to realize, like, you know, they're not sad, right? They're hungry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's like not, it's like misfiring and hitting the wrong thing. It's like the mapping's bad because you might have like these preconceived notions or beliefs that aren't really, you know, true. They're beliefs, but you think they're truths, which we've run into a lot of times with people who do a lot of analysis or therapists. You know, it all comes down to like your emotional state and being able to have like what the poets used to, I like to think about the Victorian poets, and they had this idea of the looking glass self. And they, within a lot of the Victorian poets, like deep work, they're analyzing that looking glass self in their art. And they're doing all that, that self-analysis. And if anybody that's a creative type of person, it's an author or a music, like a song singer, songwriter, we do a lot of that with our art. We try to use art as a catharsis to kind of run through that looking glass self and make it universal, so that if we feel melancholy, then the audience feels the melancholy. We feel anger, they feel anger, they feel rage. You feel you're able to kind of give it a name and turn that emotion into art and work through it and make it understandable to the rest of the world. And so, like, if you can do that assessment, you can start to say, well, should I, you know, work on that?
Well, yeah. I mean, if you're working to let it out, right? And that's the problem. That's where, you know, I'm not artistic by nature, right? Like I didn't have any outlets really, except for stuffing my face with food when I was a lot younger. I had been through childhood sexual abuse. My mom was an alcoholic. She died of alcoholism. And I lived in a very made up world kind of in my head as to what my reality was. But that's kind of what, you know, got me through. And, you know, when you start to face reality, you know, you see a therapist to get through it. It's about letting it out, right? So artists and people, as long as you can identify what it is that you're letting go of, I think it's good to let go. But, you know, if you're painting out, you know, my bad divorce, that's really good. It's because it's about processing it. It's the same when you're hungry. And if you don't eat and the body sends you signals, eventually you're going to be so hungry, you're famished. And it's a whole different kind of problem. But that's what happens with our emotions. We have other problems because we're not like addressing them. So through art, I like that a lot. And then also just writing out, like I still do this to this day. If there is something that I'm upset about, I will just write. And the exercise is just to write without editing, write without questioning. Journal. Let process. Not just even journal, but just writing without intention. Don't write, you know, just the intention is to figure out what's wrong, but let the brain let it all out.
Your flow state. roast-y type of thing.
Yes. Where it's just coming, you don't sit there and mind if you have a period or not. There's no editing. Yeah. It's just coming out, and it's surprising when it comes out. It's like, whoa! Like I thought I was upset about this, but it's related to this, and I feel relief. And there are some people in the mental health world who feel like that's as or more important than even seeing a therapist. But if you can't get started, you know, I would never say, you know, don't see a therapist. But at the same time, I think you can see a therapist for too long and keep living, not processing and releasing. You just keep living inside of your past, and you're never able to see yourself as anything other than the problems that you've had in the past, right? Like you label yourself, oh, like I don't see myself as a victim anymore. I don't see myself as anything but human. I let go of all the labels that I had: daughter of an alcoholic, victim of sexual abuse, divorcee, you know, I let it go and I see myself differently. And so that makes me feel myself differently.
Well, I believe the flow state, like a lot of people feel that artists are somehow in this like tier that they can't reach. But as you indicated, like you didn't feel like you had artistic capability, but I would say every human being has that kind of artistic capability. They might not believe that it's at the level of what they call an artist, but it is that flow state that you can get into, and you don't have to be a so-called artist to be in the flow state. You can get into a flow state without being a pianist, without being the guitarist, without being a painter. You can get into that to help yourself, like you said, through not just journaling, but kind of just this in the moment processing your emotions and finding a way to do that looking glass self analysis, you know, and maybe writing it down or voicing it out on a voice memo or something, just so that you have it, so you can go back and like, oh, cause this is what I'm actually feeling. This is what I'm, you know, you can start to process those things without it all being internal.
Right. And just like food, you want to digest it and then let it go, so to speak. You know, we don't want to just keep regurgitating it, you know, chewing the cud, so to speak, like a cow. They have multiple stomachs. So that's why they need to chew the cud. They what's the word? I'm trying to think of the word, ruminate. They ruminate. And so when we ruminate, we keep trying to digest or excuse the term, but we barf it up and chew it again and put it back down. And so, that's why the whole idea of don't ruminate. You've only got one emotion, you know, try and have one emotional stomach and let it go.
Yeah. I think it's a good place because a lot of people have been taught like shame for letting it go. They kind of been told to suck it up. So if you've come from the kind of like a family or a household or society that tells like you don't have a right to say anything, that's a complaint, that's not a good look, that's not what you should do, you need to suck it up and not deal with it. And I think that becomes harmful because like anything, like toxicity, it's like dangerous to have all that toxicity or not handle what is actually really happening and not and kind of push it down. Then it tends to, you know, cause disease, all types of disease, whether it's physical or mental.
That's exactly what this book is about, because we learn how to not feel the feelings. And so when you don't feel your feelings, it's a single system. So if you go like this to your eyes, you're not going to see, right? Like it doesn't matter what it is, like you're just not going to see it. So the same can happen with our interoceptive system, where we feel our feelings in our body. And if we shut those down, we're going to be shutting down a lot of other feelings too. Like we can't like shut down hunger 100%, but some people get really good at ignoring them. And it takes a huge, huge, you know, physical event for them to say, okay, I have to eat. So that's very true. Like we have people tell us not to feel, men especially, you know, Big Boys Don't Cry, that whole stuff that's full of crap, to be quite honest. I mean, everybody, it's a physical release that some people just don't get. And it's not just men. I have a girlfriend who was raised in a very abusive home where you couldn't show your feelings. So it becomes a problem, right? Because now you go into a house, you don't know how to have your feelings. You don't know how to share or show your feelings. And then you raise children who don't know how. So it just becomes exponential. And you have a world full of people who can't connect to feelings. And how do you know, you wonder why we're having some of the problems that we have. And you think, well, how could someone do that to someone else? They likely can't feel their feelings just because they don't know how. And I mean, literally don't know how.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of things that seem so obvious. Like if you're a logically thinking person and you try to say, well, you know, this is black and white and this is on and off. So, you know, this is right and wrong, but then there are gray areas. And this is where people get caught up because then they have these, like, you know, these preconceived notions, or they're coming from dogma, or they come from these different societal aspects that get put on them. And so they're willing to turn a blind eye to what's in front of them. They're, you know, yes. They're able to actually, the sky is purple when it's blue. Because they've been told that's how to process that. So then you're like, well, how could they see that? Well, they've been kind of processed to, you know, conditioned to see that. So if you get into that kind of mindset, then it's hard to get overcome it because they're not actually dealing with what's there. But that's what's there to them. They perceive that. They've been conditioned to take that and read it that way.
Yes, yes. And a lot of the time, it's around fear. And where you have fear present, you can't have curiosity. And when fear is present, it makes the perceptions that you have much more narrowed. When you are, you know, facing a tiger in the jungle, you don't notice everything else that's going on around you. Fear focuses you. And and so until you can get pulled back from fear, maybe the next step is being cautious. I talk about this in the book, go from fear to caution to curiosity, because in a curious state, which is in opposition to fear, you are able to take in more information. It allows you the ability to be a critical thinker because you're questioning things more. And honestly, like, curiosity is what I push for everybody to become more curious, because you know what? We'd like to think, right, that like what we were taught by our parents, our religion, our governments, our schools is 100% true. But if it's fear-based, there's usually a control mechanism behind it. And that's when it's a good time to question it.
Because a lot of times in political science, when you look at like an oligarchy or democracy, you look at dictatorship, you look at like, well, the strong man sometimes gets popularity because people want to let go of that day-to-day decision. They don't want to be responsible, right? So they feel more secure if they don't have to deal with it. So they'll give up their freedom to have a sense of security and safety. And then people would like, well, why would you do that? It doesn't make sense. But then people inside of that, if you study what happened within that oligarchy or authoritarian regime, and you start looking at it from a sociological and psychological perspective, it's like, wow, these people felt a comfort. They felt security. They felt safety, you know, to a certain point, and then they didn't. But it's like, so sometimes you have to have that curious nature, but you tend not to have that curious nature if you get affected by that. If the safety, because you're scared of that saber tooth or the wolf at the door, but it's not a wolf at the door. You've been told that fear is this other person or this other idea. And so then now that becomes as real as the saber tooth or the wolf.
So I'm going to suggest that a lot of us were bred for being a follower and not a thinker. A lot of rules have been put in place, and challenging those rules could get you in jail or excommunicated or in trouble somehow because you didn't stay, and everyone just has all these really black and white rules like you were talking about earlier. And so if you've been bred, so to speak, like this is just how it's been. So think about how many people never made a decision for themselves, just even in the Catholic Church. Like there's all of these rules that tell you, you know, what to do. And so you don't learn to think for yourself. And I'm not begrudging any religion or any, you know, I'm not trying to sit here and bag on things, but if you don't have that freedom to think for yourself and have that curious nature, I mean, look at how many curious scientists got killed by the Catholic Church.
Yeah.
So you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so I understand why you could see a nation of people who were bred to look for a leader to tell them what to do, because they were not bred to think independently. And and that's a shame. It's a real shame.
Well, it's easier to manage. Like if you have independent thought, then the so-called leaders or the top structure can't get obedience. They can't get you to follow their rules. If everybody says, look, I'm going to question why that decree was made, well, then it's not going to get followed. And so that curiosity, well, you're going to probably get thrown in the cell. Because so the curiosity is punished. So if your curiosity is punished, then you don't get a reward for it. You get discouraged from it. So I think societal, from a sociological perspective, has had these kind of top-down discouragements for independent thinking and critical thinking. They say it's easier to go along, to get along, than to question, like, why should we do that? Does that really make sense? Does that make sense for me? Maybe it makes sense for you. Doesn't make sense for me. So I don't think I should do it.
yes and trying to make make everyone follow your rule, right? Like, and I mean, we're heading, if you look at the extremes politically in this country, if you don't agree with us, you're out.
I mean
it's like, no, wait, people, what year is this? We're still doing this. We are still like trying to say my way or the highway.
It's very polarized. You know, where is the ability to be kind of like, you know, like if you think about like a Socratic method and the type of thinking that if you go to like a Harvard, you go to a Bowdoin, you go to Amherst College, I actually went to Bowdoin. It's like the idea is it wasn't just multiple choice. When I did my exams, I had to do oral exams and blue books and actually show that I actually understood the material by not just regurgitating, but showing how I could apply it. And if you're only told to say yes, no, choose, then you don't actually get a way to show that you actually have a good command of what you just learned, then you don't really learn critical thinking.
No,
you get a certificate just because you hit the right dots on the thing, but it doesn't mean that you actually know it.
It's so true. I talk about this in my book, Conversational Receptiveness. I got it from a study that was done where it's like, how do you have conversational receptiveness in a world that's so polarized right now? And, you know, the idea is that you are able to consume and consider another point of view. And most people consume only to refute, not to say, I can understand why you're doing, like, why you feel this way, what this is about, and then even might be open to changing your viewpoint because it's added to your knowledge base a different flavor in that recipe that might, you know, change its outcome. And that is just so lacking. And if we can, and most of the time, I know with me, and I always use about this, I have a feeling in my chest area, like right around my heart, when someone says something that I'm like I can just feel this, like, this sensation coming over my body. And now I know, like, okay, I got to question this. Like, what is that about? Like, why are you having that feeling? What did they say? And is it really that bad? Or do you need to consider this? It's just a heightened sense of self-awareness that we need to develop for critical thinking, for emotion management, for thought management, for just life in general. And
empathy. I mean, I think some people don't have empathy, right? So, like, if you get taught in your whatever learning phase you're in, right? If you're taught to, like, well, argue both points, both sides, be able to argue both issues so you can understand, like, okay, you don't believe in this, but go and make the argument to justify what they're saying. So you have to do the research. You have to have some empathy. You have to understand the problem, understand what they're saying. But if you're only talking, I just stay on this side the whole time. I never even go to try to understand the other side.
Yeah.
And I think the whole idea of kind of like the Socratic method or the kind of more enlightened, the enlightenment was like, oh, you start to question things. You start to look at it both sides. You look at, well, are there other options? You know, is there only one answer? Are there multiple answers? Or a little bit of everything? And you know, it's harder to do that.
Empathy is one of those words where sometimes when I hear it, I cringe a little bit, because your empathy can lead you to be too sympathetic to a particular point of view, right? So in a conversation, if you have a lot of empathy for someone, it can be just as bad as fear, because you block out any other points of view, or you don't have in consideration, like, you have an employee who's having a lot of problems and you're empathetic to them because you had similar problems, and you find all of your attention going to that person. And that's just in one circumstance. And so others go to the wayside. So this is why being in touch and having this kind of self-awareness helps you to recognize when your empathy is getting in the way and when compassion is more needed, because you're able to observe what's going on around you and say, hey, I'm not taking care of this because I am so emotionally aligned with this person. And so, it can create conversational problems if you have too much of it or none, right? It's all about finding balance.
I think it's more from a Buddhist perspective. There's like a balance. So empathy would kind of be like the empathy to understand individuals, not just to be focused on, like, I only understand this individual because I'm empathetic with them, but to understand everybody, right, as much as you can, to see that these are valid human beings that have emotions. But if you feel like this person doesn't have they're not valid, those, what they're feeling is not valid, you can't even imagine it, you can't even think about it, that becomes a problem, because it's not a balance. It's really about the balance of compassion, the balance of empathy, the balance of anything you do. Because if you go to the extremes on anything, then tend not to go well.
1,000%. I couldn't agree with you more. A long time ago, I was going to do this kind of a consulting or a coaching group with my friends, and it was called Balance Bureau, because it's, you know, if you think about everything in the world, we need balance, right? You too much or too little of anything, like, we have cortisol going through us all the time. It's not like cortisol is bad. It's when it gets out of balance. You know, we can drink too much water and drown internally. The earth is constantly trying to create balance. Our body is constantly trying to create balance, a framework of between here and here where we can live, not necessarily smack in that middle, but this framework of between these two points, that means that we're not too hot or we're not too cold, or we have enough water or not enough water. And that's really what I think all of us should strive to do. And Buddhism is such a wonderful philosophy and a way of thinking that I think helps target balance.
Yeah, because a lot of times people don't realize, like, Western thought sometimes does not consider like Gaia balance. They're balanced. They might say, well, you know, my profit is more important. My ideology is more important. Then things get out of sync. It's like Gaia has a balance. Like if you put it out of balance, then humanity might not be able to be on Gaia. You might be able to have insects rule Gaia because you've changed the balance that's actually in their favor.
Yes.
Be out of balance.
Yeah. Did you see that movie, The Biggest Little Farm?
Oh, I don't think I saw it, but I'll check it out.
Oh, man. It's just so amazing. It's about this couple who buy this, just a dirt farm. It was just in no shape at all. And the shape of the farm at the end, it's because they hired a consultant who helped them to create a balanced farm, not just crops, but how the animals that they had, they had problems with like slugs or something. So they got all these geese. And then, you know, it was like, as they started to try and create balance, animals started coming to their farm that helped to keep that balance. So nature looks for it. And what was really interesting is that there was a really bad rainstorm and there was just water rushing everywhere. And the topsoil and some of the other farms that did that overproduction one crop were washed away. All the topsoil was gone and their farm was kept intact just because they went in harmony with the earth, with nature. And so it survived. And I think when we start to try and look to how we can live physically and emotionally balanced and in harmony with who we are and what we're supposed to be, I feel like that's when we are resistant to all of the storms and floods that come our way.
Yeah, a lot of times our emotional topsoil can easily get washed away because we're kind of one trick ponies. Like, but you put all your eggs in one basket, something comes along and it just knocks it off. Because like you've made yourself so out of balance and you might think that that's the way you need to be because you're thinking about like one goal. Like one
like thing. Like that bodybuilder you referred to, right?
Yeah. It's like you get out of sync and then people think, well, that's the goal. The goal is to have the six pack. If you don't have emotional balance, where you could be suicidal, where you could be unhappy, you could be down in a dump. So you could you're not how are you living if you're not happy? So you thought X would make you happy, but it didn't make you happy. So you put all your effort into one like leg of a whole process. There's a lot of pieces to being like a whole self. And sometimes I think a lot of human beings want to go get the 10 step one way to one pillar. And then they wonder why it doesn't work. Cause like we just did 10 steps on one pillar, but they got three other pillars. Like what did you do about those?
No. Yeah. It's funny how, the whole scriptural term, you reap what you sow. And if you're sowing, in multiple places, like you're talking about, I don't know why I was thinking about this today, and I'll just, maybe it was to talk about it on this show, but I was thinking about how so many parents, like I live across the street from a park, and this woman had a baby in a swing, a young child, and she's on her phone. And I was thinking, you know, this reminds me a lot of that old, Harry Chapin, Cats in the Cradle. And it's a guy who spent all of his time on work. He just was gone. He never saw his kid. And his child would say, "Dad, when are you coming home?" And he'd say, "Oh, we'll get together soon." But he didn't pay attention. And so I think like now you see these parents who are complaining that their kids are always on their phone. But when they were with their children, they may have already been on their phone, always been on their phone. So it's being present and valuing what it is you want to create, right? And it's trying to observe what you're doing today. What is it going to sow tomorrow? And like you said, are you doing enough things to cover all of your bases, your spiritual side, your physical side, your emotional side? Like, are you cultivating friendships? Are you a loner? maybe putting more effort into certain areas that you're lacking, but not just focusing on one area like you were talking about. I thought that what you said was beautiful.
Yeah, it's a hard thing because a lot of times, like, you know, we tend to be such an immediate society. And, you know, social media makes it very easy to get stuck on, like, the quick fix. And most things, you know, it's not going to be a quick fix. It's not that you can't do it. But what I find is that you need to be able to incrementally do something you can stick with. Yes. And the quick fix is usually you don't stick with them. So it's not sustainable. So if you can't find a way to be sustainable in your self-care, then you're probably going to fail because you got to be able to do it every day for the rest of your life. And if you, if it's so hard that you can't, well, you're not going to stick with it.
Right. My, someone that I work with, she asked me, well, how are you happy? Like, how do you find happiness? And I said, I notice it. Like, one of my favorite things is when I go to bed at night, I've got our two puppies at the bottom of the bed, and my husband's, you know, usually asleep before me anyway, and the four of us are all together on the bed. And I'm like, I'm so happy in this moment. Or when we're eating a really good meal and I stop and notice it, like, and I'm like, oh, this is really making me happy. And happiness is not something that just comes, it's noticed. And same with a lot of other things in life. So I'm not happy every day because, you know, of one thing. I'm happy just every day because I'm aware of my happy moments. And it's hard to do that when you're on social media. You're seeing other people's happy moments, not yours.
But you get taught to ignore the thousands of little moments that are happiness to happen every day. It's like probably tons of micro little moments.
Yes.
That you're happy. And, but you've been looking at, like, well, I got to get $1 billion. I got to win the lottery. I got to be like X. I've been the comparison trap. I got to be like the Joneses. I'm not like the Joneses. So now I'm not happy. Even though a bunch of good things happened today, but I can't compare to the Jones. So now I'm unhappy. So it's like you go past your immediate and looking at this thing that's unattainable at the moment. And you're thinking that everything's over because, like, oh, I can't match the Joneses. And that's kind of sad, but that's how a lot of people get led around by that. But you have to kind of learn how to not be as influenced by it.
Yes. And part of when you're not influenced by other people so much and you start to look and kind of, you know, really get to know yourself. And I mean, it's an old term, it's really cliche, but when you are able to understand what you like and what you don't like, what you want and what you don't want, all of these things, what you learn to understand what brings you joy. You learn to understand what brings you love. You learn to understand what brings you fear, what brings you anger, what brings you all of your emotions. There's an exercise in the book, and it's all about understanding, like, the ingredients. What has to happen for me to feel something? And when you start looking at what has to happen for you to feel something, that's when you start to uncover, like, whoa, that's kind of dumb. It's a free flow exercise, like we were talking about earlier, but very specific into a particular emotion as to what has to happen. And that's when you start to really kind of dig into, like, that doesn't make sense. And so I want to redo my recipes or stop cooking that or whatever you want to, however you want to phrase it. So that you are, like we had talked about, like, you're cultivating and you're able to notice it when you decide, like, you want something or this is what brings you happiness. You'll notice it more. Just like the things that you don't want to have happen, but it's what makes it happen. You notice it more too. I always like to say that the example of, I never ever saw as many Teslas on the road until after I did a test drive on a Tesla.
Yeah, that happened.
I loved that thing. Right. But see what I've done. I have associated joy and actually, it was just amazingly fun. That car was just one of the best cars to drive I've ever driven. But and now my brain was like, here's joy. See that joy this other guy's driving? Yeah. Yeah, it's exactly it.
As soon as you're like into something, you know, you find it everywhere. Like I'm a mountain biker and like I want this frame, go to the mountain, suddenly I see that bike everywhere. And I probably was there probably the day before, but I didn't see it because I wasn't paying attention to it. So that seems like our mind will focus on these things. Like wherever you, if you kind of map your focus, you can actually get your mind to do things. Even subconsciously, it seems to come up. Like, wow, why is that coming up? Well, because you kind of put a focus on it.
Exactly. And it's not like I was, I guess, you know, it wasn't like I was focused on finding them, but my brain was making me aware of them because I had joy with it. And so
yeah, you found something.
And yes. And so that's why until we know our ingredients for the feelings that we don't want, it makes it harder for us not to see them as much.
Okay. I would think definitely. But like in closing, because we're hitting our hour mark.
Oh, wow, that was a fast hour.
It always goes by fast. But are there three kind of lessons learned from your book maybe people could take away, like high level?
Absolutely. I give you examples and help you to understand why your brain gets things wrong. So why you can't take everything you feel as a fact and everything you think is a fact. And I think that gives us the humility. And then the book also kind of helps us to develop this connection. You know, we need connection to other people, but the connection that we have to start with is our internal connection. So I help explain this interoception, this sensory system that if we can develop a closer relationship with, to understand the communication that's going back and forth, it raises our self-awareness tremendously. And then lastly is that we are responsible for our emotions as much as we want to blame other people. And that humility of our brain being wrong, plus that we produce our own emotions, gives us a real sense of control and strength. And so when you are at the helm and you're the driver, so when you can take your life in the direction you want to, but having that connection to yourself helps you to steer the road. And then I feel like connection to other people is just that much easier, that much stronger. And you're aware of those vibes even more so. So I think those are the top three.
That's awesome. But we always like to ask that question to get our guests to kind of impart that. But I want to thank you again for being a guest on the Fam Electric Ghost podcast. It's always great to talk to new people with different viewpoints. That's the whole point of the show. Like I said, we've been live on YouTube and Twitch. There was an issue with Facebook, but it will be loaded to Facebook after they had some kind of connection problem. But we will be live on all the big platforms. The live broadcast will be rebroadcast on all the major podcast platforms by tomorrow. So I just want to let people know that. We'll give you, your audience, a landing page so they can check it out wherever they're comfortable listening or watching to podcasts. But thank you again for being on the show.
Thank you. Thank you so much. It was such a pleasure, and I really, really appreciated being here and getting to share, but also listening to you. It's always great to have conversations, right?
Yes, as always. Thank you. Have a great night.
You as well.